Hello there. We recorded this episode before the reports of what seems to be a limited Israeli action against Iranian sites early on Friday morning. That came as Israel continues to debate how best to respond to last weekend's Iranian attack on the country, the fallout from which is ongoing. It means the issues Jonathan and I discuss in this week's episode are very much still with us.
The Middle East and a watching world waits for Israel's response to Iran's attack last weekend. We speak to two people, one Israeli, one Palestinian, about the day after and what comes next. And with the festival of Pesach, Passover, upon us, we ask how it's possible to celebrate freedom in a time of war. It's Unholy. I'm Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian in London.
And I'm Yoni Levy of Channel 12 News in Tel Aviv. It's Unholy, two Jews on the news. You know, it's Pesach is upon us. I think this is not the year we need to ask Ma Nishtana, what is different this year. Usually we ask on Pesach Eve what is different this night. But now the holiday of liberation from slavery, and can this be in any way that kind of festival of freedom? What festival and what freedom? There are 133 Israeli hostages held by Hamas more than 6 months. So it's really difficult. It's difficult for Israelis here. I think it's difficult for Jews abroad. I heard the mother of one of the hostages, Alon Ohel's mother, and she said she asks everyone to set aside a seat for a hostage. Usually Jewish tradition is to set aside a seat for Elijah the prophet, Eliyahu Navi, but she asked, this is what you should dedicate that chair for. And when we think of, you know, Jonathan, how we say every year that in every generation one is obligated to see oneself. Personally, when out of Egypt, I think we should maybe be obligated to see ourselves as someone who is personally still held in Gaza.
I mean, plenty of synagogues around the world have, since October the 7th, added a prayer for the hostages. So that's been woven into Judaism already for some time, for the whole period. But I think now it's going to really bring it home, quite literally, in the sense of the Seder, the first night of Passover, of Pesach, is something that is marked not in synagogues, it's in people's homes. It's around their family tables where they, you know, bring relatives, but also friends. I think that's something that people who are not Jewish find unusual, that it's a kind of religious service, but it's done just, you know, privately or in family context. But I think it's absolutely, as you say, it's going to be front and center in people's minds, the war, the bloodshed, but very specifically, all that freedom is mentioned, captivity is mentioned, bondage, the urge, the desperate urge to escape from captivity runs all the way through the Seder. And I think it will make it very, very charged and very poignant. I mean, we said a couple of weeks back that people were not really feeling it around Purim, the festival of Purim, which is meant to be joyous and party and so on. That was certainly my impression around here, and I think you said very much the same in Israel. I feel that Pesach is going to be different in the sense that I think people have been looking forward to it on some level and kind of need it, is the impression I get. In the very specific sense of being together with other Jews, with family, round a table. It's not, I always feel the need to stress this too, something that's unusual. You know, one thing that is always a big disconnect between Jews and the people they live among in diaspora is the big fuss that's made around Christmas time, because people write whole newspaper columns of, I've got the family coming for dinner, how's it going to be? You know, we call that Friday night, we're used to that. You know, it's not that big a deal for families together. That happens often. With Pesach, it's more people. It's kind of extended family. But I just think the chance to sit down around a table in a kind of structured way and talk about what we're all going through, discussion is a big part of the Passover Seder always. And this year, I think it's going to have that extra weight and charge.
We remember we talked to Rabbi Angela Buchdahl last week, and she told us about families being sort of anxious about the fact that, you know, people around the Seder table are going to argue maybe specifically about Israel. They have different views. And she said, try not to preach, try to listen to the other and be patient. I think that was some good advice. So that is about Pesach, I have to tell you about what is the sort of mood in this country. I mean, we had an urgent episode, but we still need to sort of immerse ourselves in the fact that Iran, for the first time, attacked Israel in the night between Saturday and Sunday. And the weird thing about it, really, this was, you know, an unprecedented attack, but anyone strolling around Tel Aviv Sunday afternoon wouldn't have known this had taken place. I mean, you know, Israelis are very used to maybe rocket attacks, not this kind of level, but I think they're also a very resilient bunch. So maybe that explains a little bit of the fact that really life bounced back so quickly. I mean, you know this country very well. It was still a little bit shocking to see just how quickly people were back at the beach, people were back at restaurants. I do think, though, that in this case, we've normalized it very quickly. And it makes you wonder, because after so many years of skirmishes with Hamas, you know, 10 days of rockets, and then Israelis go back to their lives. And it's remarkable the way that they kind of stand up and they're resilient. But our enemy isn't going back to their lives. They're not sitting at the beach. They're not going to Pilates class. They're actually planning a war against Israel. And that complacency, to me, is something that I would maybe look at again. I mean, I always looked at our resilience as something that is such an advantage, so remarkable. But I don't know. Maybe we're too resilient. Maybe we're borders on complacent. I don't know if I'm saying anything that makes sense. But looking at how Israel has bounced back as if no one attacked it 5 days ago is just pretty remarkable.
I think that's so interesting because it's definitely a trait, as you said, it's an idiosyncrasy of the Israeli character. I remember during the second intifada, you would go to a place where a suicide bombing had been the day before, and you would not know that just from... you would see people back into the hustle and bustle of normal life, sometimes even hours later. Whereas here, you know, if there's a road traffic accident, there are flowers arranged and cards for weeks and weeks, sometimes even months and years. Israel has this thing which you definitely feel is partly resilience, but also a kind of denial, which is just put it out of our minds, look ahead, don't look over your shoulder, don't look back. Because if you do, it's too awful to contemplate. In this case, you know, you mentioned rightly the word unprecedented about this attack, often overused word journalistically. In this case, it's absolutely true. Iran has never attacked the sovereign territory of Israel. And here it did. That's a huge deal. But there is a kind of defect in, you know, you've talked about the Israeli imagination, in the news business in particular, globally. There's a real processing problem in understanding something as huge and momentous if there's nobody dead. You know, the old saying about sort of news, if it bleeds, it leads, you know, and it kind of, if it doesn't bleed, then somehow it can't be that epic and significant. This is hugely significant, even though remarkably, wonderfully, no one was killed. And I think the people have sort of underestimated how significant it is. In two ways, as we said in the emergency update episode, one, this first ever attack from Iranian sovereign soil onto Israeli sovereign territory, but also how it was averted in terms of bloodshed, which is this alliance of Israel and its neighbors, Arab states protecting Israel from Iranian fire. This is a massive epochal moment. And yet, in a way, because people go back to the beach the next day and because, thankfully, no one dead, it's easy to miss.
Yeah, I mean, and in the meantime, of course, the looming question, this isn't over. In a way, maybe this is just the beginning, because the looming question now is, what is Israel's response? What should it be? Should there be a response? And what is the level of how Israel should respond? We talked a little bit about this dilemma in our update episode. But on the one hand, a country attacked you with 330 projectiles, right, in one night. So the fact is that you, any normal country, would probably respond. The issue here is, do you start a spiral that you don't know what the response to the response will be when you're still fighting two wars, essentially, in Gaza and in the northern border? Is this the time to do it? And I have to tell you that what you hear, the cabinet and the defense echelon pretty much monolithic on this, saying we must respond. And our assessment is that Iran does not want an escalation. Now, I want to focus on that sentence for a minute, because for many, many years, the Israeli public has been told Hamas is not interested in an escalation. Hamas is deterred. That turned out I'll say this mildly, not to be the case. Now, Israeli intelligence has very serious people involved, military intelligence, other intelligence agencies. But they were wrong twice in 7 months. They were wrong catastrophically on October 7th, when they didn't assess Hamas's plans properly. And they were wrong when they didn't realize what the response would be to the assassination of Zahedi in Damascus, right, which started this whole story. They thought Iran's response would be low-key. So the Israeli public is quite trepidatious when it hears the same people with the same assessment saying Iran does not want an escalation. We think that if we respond, the response will then be low key. So this is, again, this is the conversation happening now in the room of the war cabinet and in every table in every house in Israel. I should tell you that from everything that I understand, the most hawkish person in the room, in that room, the cabinet room that is going to make that decision, is actually not Benjamin Netanyahu, but he's definitely pressed by a lot of his base to go, you know, to this sort of full-on response. Israel's been pretty smart in, you know, its actions vis-a-vis Iran for many years. You know, that a lot of low-profile things, you know, according to foreign reports, we know what they were. So the question is, why do something very big, or why do something now? Why do something on Iran's soil? You know, there are a lot of questions here.
Before I get into some of them, just on that point about who is the most hawkish person mm-hmm. in the room, because we know in the wider cabinet, of course, the far right, Ben-Gvir, Smotrich, but in the war cabinet, if Netanyahu is not the most hawkish in the room, who is?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question. And I think that there are two sort of elements to look at here. One is the military itself. The head of the military, of course, Chief of Staff Herzi Halevi, and he and Defense Minister Gallant are considered to be the ones who would want a sending a message to Iran. It's interesting to note that the two people who you would sign as the moderates in the war cabinet, i.e. ministers Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, were both very adamant on attacking Iran the night of the attack. What they said was, when the Iranians come to attack us, we go and attack them. That was aborted by the prime minister. This is interesting in itself. So those are the voices. And that is a very interesting picture. I think it goes to show that this is not a simple question. This is not a simple dilemma.
No. And that, again, is something we said when you and I spoke in the immediate aftermath of this. Just firstly, that notion of Netanyahu being in some ways relatively restrained, that's on brand for old Netanyahu. You know, that was always a feature of him, that yes, you know, very aggressive political figure, but quite cautious in terms of military engagement. And part of the narrative of recent months had been that that person had been changed by, or sort of receded because of the pressures on him, particularly with his coalition and so on. So that's an interesting thing. If we're back to that dynamic where he is in some ways the voice of relative, underlined, restraint. On the point about the Israeli public feeling like, look, we have been burnt before by listening to this relatively reassuring advice that enemy X has been deterred, and it turns out they really haven't. I would just say on this very specifics about the April the 1st operation, I don't think we can exclude Netanyahu from that failure of calculation. As I understand it, the decision did go all the way up to him, and he is one of those who underestimated the Iranian response. Now, maybe he would say on advice that he got, but I'm not sure it did require great strategic thinking to know that this would be a big deal with the Iranians. And I remember in our conversation with Amos Harel of Haaretz, all three of us were sort of a bit shocked by his reporting that that nobody, including at the very highest level, had thought through the implications of this action. The argument that's going on outside Israel is partly about the rights and wrongs of this, which may not surprise you. And there has been an argument about this sort of tit-for-tat idea, which is, okay, Israel did its attack on April the 1st on Iran's sovereign territory, albeit in Damascus, and then now Iran has done its response by attacking Israel's sovereign territory. We're even. Call it quits. That's been the message from the White House. That's been the message from the various foreign ministers, British foreign minister, German foreign minister in Israel this week, saying, you know, they've hit you, you've hit them, draw a line under the episode. It may surprise people that I'm not sure about that thinking completely. And in this way, I don't think there is a match between an attack, an all-out attack unloading vast amounts of ordnance on Israel. I read that it is more than Russia unloaded on Ukraine the first night of the invasion in February 2022. Again, difference being that this time there was no bloodshed, but that was the scale of the attack on the whole population, and calling that equivalent with a diplomatic building, and even that's a bit of a grey area in Damascus because it's next to, it's a sort of compound adjacent to a consulate. And, you know, as I've been sort of saying to people, Iran's presence in Syria is not quite like, you know, the Canadian embassy in Stockholm. They are there as a military player. They were there fighting, remember, over the last decade, from fighting Assad's war against his own people. It was Iranian military, Iranian equipment that was involved in that fight, which led to hundreds of thousands of Syrians dead. It's not quite the same as just saying, well, you know, it's a consulate. So I just think when you're into the rights and wrongs of this and tit for tat, as you said, it's complicated. Appearances can be a little bit deceptive.
Yeah. And let's just add to that, by the way, that the 6,000 drones Russia used in Ukraine are Iranian
made,
drones,
exactly.
Right? And so there's something that isn't complicated. Iran is a malignant actor. Its regime has been behind terror attacks against America, against Israel, against other Western nations. This is a power, this regime, I want to say, that is the neighborhood bully, and that's the most courteous reading I can give of this regime. This is not the good guys, you know, responding to an assassination. And the person who was assassinated is, again, according to foreign reports, Israel did this. This is someone who, you know, whose whole logic in life, his whole mission in life was to connect between Iran and its proxy Hezbollah to make more terror attacks. So this is not, I mean, that we have to maybe say that to anyone arguing about the balance here in this story.
It all means that we're back into that dynamic that we have had anyway for several months of Israel, you know, itching to do one thing and the allies, particularly the United States, urging restraint. As you and I speak now, there have been reports that there is some kind of trade-off that's been agreed, reported and sourced to Egyptian officials, saying that essentially the United States has said in return for Israel showing restraint against Iran, Israel will have, as it were, permission from Washington to go ahead with that operation in Rafah, that one is going to be traded off against the other. Now, I can't vouch for that, as I say, source to Egyptian officials. But if that's the case, what it means a couple of things. First, it means that Iran, which likes to pose as a sort of great defender of Palestinians in the region, the Palestinian cause, it's thanks to them that Rafah may now get an operation that otherwise Washington may well have succeeded in restraining and holding Israel back from, that if that's right. And then the other thing is the kind of frustration that you definitely pick up speaking to Western officials, which is that Israel sort of pockets the help it got, the military help it got last Saturday night, in taking down those Iranian missiles and drones. It sort of pockets that, and instead of saying, in return, we're therefore going to be restrained, which is what Joe Biden and David Cameron and the rest have been asking for, instead it says, okay, we now want something else if we are going to be restrained in our attack on Iran, that we're not doing it as a thank you for helping us fend off this attack, rather we will pocket that and seek instead something else in return for our holding back. And according to these reports, it would be rougher. I don't know if any of that is, you know, backed up, but that's what some of those reports are saying.
Look, I would say that Israel is legitimately concerned about Iran and its proxies. You don't need to, after Saturday night, to understand why Israel is legitimately concerned and why this puts this country in grave danger. I think it could make sense for Israel to say to its allies, look, we don't want to respond. If you can help us out and help push Hezbollah much farther from the northern border of this country so that people can return, because there are tens of thousands of Israelis still evacuees, that's what we want. That makes sense to me. I don't know if this Rafah story that you're saying is indeed the case. I think it's important to remember that there's actually not an active war in Gaza as we speak. We talked about the fact that the Israeli military withdrew from Khan Yunis. That allows from people from Rafah to move back to Deir el-Balah. Deir el-Balah is the center of the Gaza Strip. That's why you're seeing pictures that in Israel got quite a lot of attention of people at the beach of Deir el-Balah. So we are seeing the shrinking of the Israeli operation in Gaza. Hamas has not been eliminated or crushed, however many times the Israeli prime minister says we are just one step away from total victory. And so the point is right now that Israel is at crossroads. Does it continue its war in Gaza? Does it say, stop, we're trying to get the hostages out, we're trying to solve the situation in the north, we're trying not to get into a regional war with Iran, or something else? I, at this point, don't know what side of the road we're deciding to take.
As you say, people are wondering where this all goes. We have been wondering for a long time about the really long-term outlook. What happens the day after and the day after that? We're not at that point just yet, but people are inevitably thinking about it and what the long-term future holds. We also felt somehow at this season of reflection that comes with Passover, it would be good to take stock, like people are doing around family Seder tables all over the world, but to take stock with two people who have both been, in their own ways, fighting a battle, often on social media, actually. Yes, with world opinion, but also taking on people on, as it were, their own side, saying things that the people on their own side would find difficult, and doing that at some cost. Two quite brave individuals, both very eloquent about the future and what may come next. I don't usually like to rely on a Twitter biography, but here's what it says about Ahmed Fuad al-Khatib, a proud American from Gaza City, pro-Palestine, pro-peace, anti-Hamas, lost 31 family members in the war, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council Middle East program. Views are my own. And I'm just going to quote what your pinned tweet or pinned X post says there, because it says a lot. I refuse to give up on seeking peace, coexistence, reconciliation, allyship, bridge building, and common ground with Israelis and Jews who want to pursue a shared future based on equality, mutual acknowledgement and trust, and just security and safety. Both people need each other. So that's Ahmed Fuad al-Khatib. Welcome to Unholy.
Thank you for having me.
And I like the Twitter bio thing, but I'm going to do my thing and say that Fani O. Salzberger is Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Haifa. She's a writer, a public intellectual, also the daughter of famed Israeli author Amos Oz, a person to turn to and to listen to in these dark days, she is for sure. If we're doing Twitter bios, I will read out, mom, Israeli, Jewish, humanist, history professor, loving daughter of Amos Oz, as we said, Tel Aviv, Oxford. Fania, thank you so much for talking to us too on Unholy. And first and foremost, we need to say that when we were talking about this conversation, you both had very warm words about each other. Can we ask where you know each other from, of each other? Could you tell us a little bit about that to start us off?
Well, there was this dark bar in Beersheba where Ahmed and I first met over a drink. No, not really. I would have loved that.
I was wondering where that dark bar is. Maybe you want to tell us. Okay.
No, that's actually next. I mean, Twitter, for as much as it's a challenging space to be on so many levels, the amount of hate and vitriol, I am immensely grateful for some of the wonderful people that I've crossed paths with on Twitter. It does not mean you're going to always agree on each and every point. It doesn't matter, you know, what, like, as long as we're motivated by that same drive towards the common ground, towards the shared future, towards the path forward. Fani, of course, has been around a lot longer than I have in this space. I was largely I consider myself a new entrant to the space in the sense that October 7th, I had like 3 Twitter followers, and now I've had a chance to grow that space. I put myself out there as a result of the horrific event, which I knew is going to be a new chapter of epic proportions for both people. I knew that it was going to be immensely damaging to my family, to my people. I knew that Gaza as we knew it was going to cease to exist. And I was horrified by the mutual dehumanization and the how the discourse was breaking down in the ways that I have, you know, observed since. So I've decided to put myself out there, and over time I've become a huge fan of Fania's ethos, her presence online, her writing, her commentary, and including on some issues that I may not see eye to eye with. But that's the whole point, is it's not to agree on everything, but it is to work across our disagreements. So I'm really grateful that our paths have crossed as a result of an unlikely place like Twitter, which just tends to bring out the worst in most people, or many people, I should say.
Well, can I just add that I'll address you directly, dear Ahmed. I'm touched and moved and delighted to meet you in digital person now here. And I'm waiting for the day in which we shall meet in person, period. I've been on X, known as Twitter, since 2011. I got on during the Arab Spring, what used to be called the Arab Spring. I changed into full English on the 7th of October. I've been waging, as I call it, waging peace ever since. Also having things to say about Hamas and what must be done with Hamas, as you know. And it's been a terribly difficult ride because you and I both meet the worst trolls of cyberspace between us, I think. And yet it was all worth it to meet a person like you and to air your views, to help you air your views among moderates around the globe, because both you and I seem to attract people who are both hopeful and moderate in different countries. And I'm very grateful for that.
So we're going to hope to tease out some of what has led your positions to come close, you know, converge close to each other. But first, we just thought we should talk about the events of the last week or so and the Iranian attack on Israel last weekend and the events that preceded it. It seems, I mean, the conversations Yoni and I have already had, this is one of those ones where it is not straightforward for anybody. I've not come across anybody yet who thinks this is a very easy decision or sort of moral conundrum to resolve exactly how Israel should react to this. Fania, just as somebody who is a kind of waging peace person, do you think those people, the Joe Bidens and Emmanuel Macrons and David Camerons, who are saying Israel should do nothing in response, should restrain itself, are they right? Is that the sort of peace position? Or do you sympathize with those who say, look, if Israel's been bombarded by this kind of level of onslaught, it has to respond militarily?
No, I think that Israel should restrain itself about Iran and resume the hostage and ceasefire negotiations in Gaza, because many of us in Israel actually suspect that the beginning of this Israel-Iran escalation, the bombing of the house next to the Iranian embassy in Damascus by the Israeli Air Force, was not the timing of it, obviously, was not much more than a ploy by our current government to delay further negotiations on the hostage deal and the ceasefire, as they have been doing for the past at least 2 months, I'm afraid. So I've got a strong opinion about Iran, obviously, but this is not for now. We need to resolve the Gaza calamity, our mutual calamity, first.
Well, what I would add to that is, unfortunately, Hamas's position has clearly hardened as a result of the Iran, the strikes by Iran. You see it with some of the mouthpieces for Hamas, the leaders. Like, it's out in the open, and it's very clear that should this escalation continue, and should Israel respond right now, at least, this will have terrible consequences in terms of Hamas being less willing to, like, viewing this as a distraction, like distracting Israel away from the Gaza war, allowing it to rebuild its capabilities, allowing it to entrench itself in Gaza, prolonging, I should say, the war. So I strongly feel that the timing of this could be calamitous in terms of just for the people of Gaza, who are kind of held hostage by Hamas, but also by the circumstances of this war that does, has no clear ending. I'm also in touch with hostage families, and I feel strongly about the need to prioritize a deal to get them out. And I just worry that further escalation with Iran moves us away from an imminent and a necessary hostage deal and a ceasefire deal.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that? You say you're in contact with them. Can you tell us a little bit more about that connection?
Well, one of the things that I find really painful and unfortunate with a lot of what you would call the pro-Palestine movement, and it's not a monolithic group, it's a very diverse set of coalitions, but I have been disappointed continuously by the lack of willingness to acknowledge the humanity of the Israeli hostages and their plight and the struggles that their families face. Mm-hmm. And yes, of course, there's the issue of, you know, the unjust detention by many Palestinians through administrative detention, through a legal system that is heavily skewed and not, you know, in favor of Palestinian rights or the presumption of innocence. However, you cannot move away from the fact that these were hostages, largely civilians, that were captured in the worst possible way you can imagine, including Arabs and Muslims and Arab Israelis and Bedouins, for goodness sake. So, and to think that a one-year-old or the elderly or peace activist being held by Hamas is not cause for empathy. Even if you despise the Israeli military's campaign and you have egregious disagreements with Israel, like, for me, I have just been so disappointed to not see more on, I hate to even use the word sides, but on our side, being very outspoken and saying, get the hostages out, we are better than this, women and children and the elderly are not to be used in releasing Palestinian prisoners. And so I have gone out of my way as someone who lost a lot of family members, who has immense allyship within the Israeli community and the Jewish American community and the diaspora Jewish community, to connect with families of hostages and to connect with, you know, like I've connected with Leora and Yaakov Argmani, who Leora is not doing well health-wise, and that's her dying wish, is to see her daughter at one last time. I connected with Judith Renan, who was actually released from captivity. Connected with Lachey, many others who maybe are hesitant to come out openly. I feel really strongly about this.
Well, if I may address you, Ahmed, directly, you know, I could have sent you one of those. I'm sure they offered you one, our hostages chain, which says in Hebrew, our heart is captive in Gaza. And I feel that your heart is in a different way also held captive in Gaza, because this is not the Gaza that you grew up in and loved. This is a different Gaza. I also want to convey my deep condolences for the death of your family members during this campaign. It's not only heartbreaking, it is also mesmerizing to see how you manage to contain the pain and to continue working for peace. This is extremely powerful and inspiring.
Just on that point, Ahmed, you mentioned your own connection with Israeli families who are going through the pain of having loved ones held hostage, and you're reaching out to them. I mean, Fania just did that with you. Have Israelis or Jewish Americans, as it were, reciprocated and expressed condolence and sympathy with you? That's one thing I want to ask. And the other thing I want to ask is whether that act of human connection that you've been able to foster with those Israeli families, is that only possible because you are a Gazan who lives in the United States, that you're away from the kind of looming policing presence of Hamas?
I mean, all the time, to your first point, absolutely. I hear from American Jews and diaspora Jews and Israelis across the spectrum. That's the key point, is I have made a point of not just focusing on engaging the leftist Israelis or the anti-Zionists or whatever, but even the center and center-right folks and the liberal Zionists. Like, I very much so believe in kind of a cross-segment engagement. And yes, absolutely, I hear sincere and genuine empathy all the time, even from folks who support the war and want it to continue, or people who, in the same breath, and I know it, for some folks, it can be hard to hold multiple truths together, but some people will tell me, I know your family's sheltering in Rafah. I'm sorry for what happened. I believe we should go into Rafah. And yet I'm really sorry for what happened to your family. Like, which I actually think is a far better position than the black and white. Well, I don't care about your family. Like, we're going to go into Rafah. Like, and that's what I hope to inspire more and more on our side. Again, I hate the side-isms. Like, I view myself as being fluid, and like, you know, I identify as pro-Palestine because I think being pro-Palestine means showing humanity to the other side and to Israelis as the path forward, not just as the talking point, not just to gain sympathy or to sound like you're taking the high ground, but as an actual somebody who experienced firsthand the benefit of communication and dialogue and engagement with Israelis, and also had a lot of uncomfortable conversations. So as for your second question, I mean, I absolutely acknowledge my privilege in being outside of Gaza and how that helps me in not being able to, in leveraging that distance to think differently, to view this differently, to step back a little bit from the horrible day-to-day. I mean, yes, the conditions in Gaza are atrocious with the not just the bombardment and the danger, but, you know, trying to, for the first 2 months of this war, talking to my brother, talking to my cousins, talking to my family members, like literally half of the day was spent trying to find water and food, like actual, like caveman style. You're going out and you're looking for it. This was before the trucks started coming in with the ceasefire, the initial temporary ceasefire. So like, I understand that somebody who's in that boat may have a harder time being able to empathize with hostage families, or to empathize with the victims of October 7th, or to even think about like how we got here, how, like, they are literally caught up in the survival. So where I am immensely frustrated and just disheartened even is that those who are in the Western world or in the Arab world and have the privilege of safety and have the privilege of being away from it at a physiological, personal, like physical sense, to not only not help the Gazans and the Palestinians in the West Bank, like offer kind of like your own assessment and offer your like give them a helping hand in seeing a path forward, but to talk over them and be and out radicalize them and outflank them in how pro-Palestine you want to become and how anti this and anti that and no Israeli hostages and boycott Starbucks and boycott McDonald's and boycott this and go do protests here and there without a vision or without a goal. That's what frustrates me. So that's where I recognize my privilege, and I want to use that. And I've never, by the way, I've never claimed to speak on behalf of the Palestinians. I've never claimed to be a leader. You know, people try to say you could be a leader. That's people's projections onto me. I am an individual who grew up. I went to UNRWA schools when I was a child. My dad ran UNRWA's clinic in Jabalia refugee camp. He passed away 4 years ago. And when he was dying, Israelis helped basically prolong his life entirely for free, for no agenda, for no return. It was done in silence and in quiet. When I came to the United States, I am largely deaf in my left ear because of an Israeli bombing that almost killed me in 2001. And it was an Israeli-American doctor that helped kind of get me the basics of, you know, understanding the my condition and having the imagery that I couldn't have in Gaza. And it's like, does that mean those people, I agree with them 100% on all the political issues? Absolutely not. One of the ladies that helped in 2020 get, or at the end of 2019, get medication to my dad was an actual settler, okay? Outright settler who got the medication from the Jerusalem and got it to the Gaza border and handed it to somebody who was going into Gaza. Does that mean I despise settlements? I despise the whole enterprise behind them. I talk about settlements all the time as a hindrance of peace. But there's totally a way in which within every one of us, there is an absolute humanity that has to be nurtured. It has to be brought out to the surface. And those of us who are outside, who have the privilege of distance and safety, I think have an obligation to contribute to highlighting that instead of further inflaming the discourse and further worsening it with feel-good slogans and activism that fail to move the needle forward.
Yeah. Fani, I mean, you've been such an important voice in the Israeli left. And I sort of want to ask you, how do we move forward from this? How do we get to the day after? What do we do on the day after? I mean, how does Israel, how do both sides see a way, a light at the end of this tunnel?
Well, I was going to say, in direct continuity to what Ahmed was telling us about those fake Palestine supporters who are only out there to dream, to fantasize on Israel being annihilated out of a hate which is deeper than the Palestinian issue. When I engage with such people, I try not to, but when I have to, the litmus test is the two-state solution. And the two-state solution is what I've been holding since my teens and all the way until now as the best, and right now I think also the only way forward for both Israelis and Palestinians. The anti-Israeli automatic pilots fume at the two-state solution. They don't want Israel at all, not even a smaller Israel next door to a sovereign Palestine in peace and prosperity. And this is one of my easiest tests to see whether I can talk to that person or not. Now, once upon a time, there were a lot of dreamers, also in the Israeli left, and certainly in the global left and among Palestinians, that we could somehow create one state, a kind of a Israelstein with the complete equality, secular, liberal, for all of us to live in peace together under the beautiful Mediterranean skies. I've always said that this solution is perhaps a bit too beautiful because there are not enough seculars and liberals on both sides, on either side, to create a secular and liberal shared state, but maybe in a generation or two. Now it looks more like three or four generations to me, because I feel strongly as an Israeli, as a left-wing Zionist, that after the 7th of October, and on this we may possibly not disagree, not agree, Ahmed, and I will definitely respect that, that after the 7th of October, we can no longer hope for one state for people from Hamas and people from the kibbutzim and people from the settlements and people from Gaza in the West Bank and the ex-Hezbollah. I don't see how this can be moved on in the coming future, in the foreseeable future. But I strongly feel that a Palestine made of the West Bank and Gaza and maybe some other parts negotiated together under a territorial agreement, perhaps one day a confederation, who knows. But first, let's, as my late father used to say, let's get an amiable divorce and share the house. Because this to me is not only the best solution, but possibly the only remaining solution that we have to look forward to. And I'm very curious to hear what Ahmed has to say about this horizon, of course.
Absolutely. I mean, I was just talking to someone yesterday about how the position has moved within the, call it mainstream pro-Palestine movement and activism spaces, to where one state that does not entail Israel in its current shape and format. I take issue with that. In one, I don't think you're going to ever get Israelis and diaspora Jews on board. But two is that, for the simple reason, if you actually talk to a lot of Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza, they will tell you, we want our own state. Like, we want a thing to be made up of Palestinians. And they might not overtly and like very explicitly say it, but they basically want something separate for the Arabs and the Christians and the Muslims and for the Jewish Israelis. Like, they will tell you that. So if your whole activism is supposedly on behalf of the Palestinian people, most Palestinians want their unique, individual, solid national identity that stands alone and out from the Israeli identity. That's number one. Number two, and I kept telling people, like, I mean, unfortunately, the lack of leadership on the Palestinian side isn't that it's just like we need a leader who, you know, like marshals us towards, like a leader is somebody who has original thought and original ideas. And as much as people want to hate on Yasser Arafat, be my guest. That's fine. I'm no fan in the big picture. But just on the piece of the moment in time when he realized that violent armed resistance was going nowhere, and that he made the courageous decision to embrace Israel and or to acknowledge and recognize Israel and to renounce violence at that time. I'm not talking about after, and I'm not talking about before. That was true rare leadership, because it was courageous. It's taking a notion that is incredibly unpopular and awakening people from the delusions. And we need something like that, that's orders of magnitudes greater in terms of wake up, Palestinian people. There's not going to be a full right of return to the entirety of historic Palestine, okay? Palestine, as we know it right now, is reduced to the West Bank and Gaza. And guess what? Things are not just measured by pure territorial spaces. Look at how many big nations there are in the world that are poor and suffering versus smaller nations like Israel or Singapore or Hong Kong or whatever. Like, Gaza and the West Bank can be a beacon, a shining a hub of Palestinian arts and culture and economic sustainment and development. We can have an airport and a seaport in Gaza. We have a gas field. We can do so much with the West Bank and Gaza. Of course, I recognize that the settlements are a major challenge and an obstacle, and there needs to either be territorial swaps, or there needs to be a situation whereby there's a consideration of absorbing some of these settlers as Palestinian residents with full rights. This is not a one-state solution, but to allow some of these folks to stay there. So the challenge for me also is that Gaza could have been a unique opportunity to showcase, to be an effective role model. And a lot of Palestinians don't want to say this, or don't want to acknowledge this, rather, because they say, oh, well, Israel continued the occupations or some elements of the occupation, even though it pulled out. There's truth to that. I get it. Fine. But you could have still, nevertheless, done so much with Gaza to force an end to the occupation, not just in Gaza and sovereignty, but in the West Bank. And unfortunately, you gave a lot of ammunition to the point of view that says, well, if we end the occupation in the West Bank, there's a risk of a Gaza 2.0. I don't subscribe to that position. I don't believe that that would happen. But I understand why people believe that. I understand why Jews and Israelis believe that. And I think, unfortunately, we failed to disarm that argument. And the blockade, by the way, on Gaza is not just that Israel just woke up overnight and decided we're going to blockade Gaza in perpetuity. There needs to be accountability and agency for the fact that Hamas announced endlessly their aim to shoot rockets and to attack Israel and to wipe it out. Like, when somebody on your next door, on your doorstep does that, what do you think is going to happen, whether it be Israel or any other nation? And again, I say this because I think if Hamas was not there, there could have been an entirely different opportunity for the Palestinians to realize Gaza first, a Palestinian state using the Gaza first approach. It is true that some Israelis or some Israeli political leaders have viewed a Gaza first as a Gaza last. Some have wanted to only have a Palestinian state in Gaza. But I think the two-state solution, Fania, to your point, is not only the only path forward, but it is a good path forward. We can develop the West Bank and Gaza to make it attractive for refugees in Jordan and in Syria and in Lebanon who are languishing as second-class citizens.
So you both agree on the ultimate day after. I don't think either of you think it's going to happen literally the day after, but that the ultimate destination is two states. So a similar question that for both of you. Each one of you faces the more extreme, more angry voices on your own side. Fania, you're facing down the right, or the Israeli or Jewish right. Ahmed, you are very forthright on Twitter denouncing Hamas by name and those people who defend it. How will you, each of you, take on those who would say, we've heard your vision of two states. The Israelis will say to you, Fania, we can't possibly allow there to be a state next door. You've seen what they did to us on October the 7th. We have to be there, boots on the ground, or some other way, controlling it. That's the message from the government. Now, we've learned our lesson from October the 7th. And Ahmed, those who will say to you in your own community, you weren't here when the bombs were falling on us. These people, what they only did to us, of course we can't shake hands and come to some kind of agreement with Israel. So I want to hear how each of you, you've sketched out the day after, but how each of you would advance that argument with your own peoples.
Okay, I will start by saying that fellow Israelis are not going to listen to me, except for the liberal left, the Zionist left, and some of the center, they would. They need to listen to a leader. So do the Palestinians. We cannot make Ahmed Fuad al-Khatib the leader of Palestine by our wishes and dreams. I wish, but this doesn't work this way. And the true leader, and you courageously mentioned the Yasser Arafat. I've never been in love with Yasser Arafat, but the Oslo Accord was created and written and negotiated very close to home, very close to my home. In several ways, and so I was deeply in it. There was no love, but there was the beginning of trust and the beginning of hope. True leader doesn't tell his or her nation what they want to hear. That's a false leader. That's what we are getting now. True leader has to tell people what deep in their hearts they know that must happen, that must be done, but refuse to say it or refuse to think it. This is my father's definition, not mine, but I embrace it. And this is why my main battle, despite my international voice I try to make, my main battle is against my own government and leadership, because they have to go, because they have to make room to a leader who would be able to tell the Israeli nation, in the hope that there would be a Palestinian leader able to tell the Palestinian nation that it's time to move on to a territorial compromise. I don't mind if it's not called peace in the coming generation. Maybe peace is now too strong a word. Maybe we are too poisoned. Maybe the air is too vitriolic. But a territorial agreement, a compromise, and neighborly relations between two free, sovereign and hopefully democratic countries. And if it comes from me or from Ahmed, it only goes so far. That is why we have to make a domestic battlefield in which we do our very best to bring the right leaders to the front. And I know the right leaders are there. We see some of them, potential great leaders in Israel, and I'm sure there are potential great leaders in the Palestinian areas too. They need to rise, we need to help them.
I just butt in before Ahmed answers. I'm gonna be some sort of representative of what I'm sure, Fania, you hear from a lot of Israelis.
Yes.
And they will tell you, Gaza was, as Ariel Sharon said after he disengaged from Gaza, dismantled all settlements, an experiment. We wanted that to become a success. What happened was tunnels longer than the Newark subway system, and terrorists abducting women barefoot with their children from their beds. This is what happened. How can you convince? And when you look at the polls, and maybe Ahmed, I'll ask you also about that, the polls that say what support Hamas has in Gaza and what support it has in the West Bank. When you look at that, how can you ever convince Israelis, you know what? A Palestinian state is a great idea. I mean, you see the numbers. And again, if we're talking about polls, 73% of Israelis are saying they're against any revitalized kind of Palestinian authority in Gaza. 63% say they're against a Palestinian state. I feel like we're having a conversation, which a lot of people could actually be very inspired with, But on the ground, does it have any sort of, is it tenable at all?
Well, 37% of Israelis are not against the Palestinian state.
That's seeing the third of the glass full, I admit. Okay.
But you know, the answer, Yonit, is that in 2005, when we disengaged from Gaza, and in 2007, when Hamas came to power, defeating the goal of the whole thing, we did not have the presence, the hands-on presence of the international community of global forces. Europe was busy, very busy with itself, if you remember, with the EU, with the expansion of the EU. The United States post 9/11 was busy with Afghanistan and with its other enemies. We did not have guardian angels. We do now, I think. We must have. You know, it takes three cherries to win money in a betting machine. I've been once to the casino, so I know you need three cherries in a row. One cherry is the Palestinian leader willing to do it. The other cherry, the second cherry, is an Israeli leader willing to do it. But the third cherry is a strong international presence and pressure. We did not have it in the first decade of this millennium. We might have it now. We need our good friends, who are also the friends of peace, to navigate both sides. Not only to a change of gear in regard to negotiations and compromise and eventually peace, but also towards de-radicalization, not only of the Palestinians, but also of us Israelis. And this has to happen as far as we can from within, but we need help from without. It's a global era, and this is a global project. It's no longer up to Israelis and Palestinians alone. We need all three cherries in a row.
Unit, like, I'll start with just your, I mean, I would argue that the absence of the, like, I understand genuinely and sincerely, like, again, with the benefit of the distance, why many Israelis would believe what they believed. And this is where we can talk about how the disengagement was executed poorly, in the sense that there was no coordination and real plans to fill in that physical and political vacuum created by vacating the settlements. We can talk about the nefarious emerging calculus within some Israeli circles and the right that decided to use the division to prevent the negotiation of Gaza and that with the Palestinians, and that there was almost a desire to see Gaza deteriorate and disintegrate to where it's at right now, and to focus resources on the West Bank because it's a bigger prize. There's more resources. There's more religious interest in the settlement enterprise, which was expanding and has a far greater, you know, like electoral significance than Gaza. So, like, we cannot ignore that component to what resulted in. But my thing is, what's the absence of a resolution, the management, like, we got October 7th in a horrible, disgusting way and a criminal way, has shown the consequences of managing the occupation, managing Hamas, bribing them with silence through Qatari funds, turning a blind eye to knowing that for years all the smuggling through Egypt had taken place, and ignoring clear and present warnings and indications. I have a degree in intelligence and national studies. Like, the writing was on the wall, all the young ladies that were warning about the Hamas trainings, like thinking that you can buy Hamas's silence. I would argue that this is not just an entirely Palestinian problem, even though I am championing Palestinian self-accountability and responsibility and agency in determining the path forward. What I will go back to is, in terms of how do you move the needle on Palestinians moving away from Hamas? Results. They need to actually see progress. They need to see that if you renounce violence, like the Palestinian Authority did, like Fatah did, like the PLO, you're not going to have an endless settlement enterprise in the West Bank that eats away what remains of Palestinian territories. So, like, yes, there needs to be a Palestinian shift and de-radicalization away from this notion of, you know, liberation from the river to the sea. But that is tied to the direct priorities and actions of the and of the Israeli government and of the occupation. And I have to say, and I talk to Israelis all the time, they're some of my closest allies. Like, for a large segment of the Israeli society, the Palestinian issue is something that is in the background, is something that is not immediately visible unless something horrible like October 7th happens. So the Palestinians will move deep down in their hearts. They know there's not going to be the end of Israel. They know there's not going to be annihilation. You know who also believes that and knows that? Hamas. Hamas is not, they're evil, but they're not stupid. They know that they cannot eradicate Israel. But I think the best antidote to radicalism in the Palestinian community is results and to show the alternative by allowing more voices like me to point, because that's the number one challenge that I get, even from the Western, you know, allies and pro-Palestine people. It's like, okay, fine, like, I don't like Hamas, but we're in this binary thing where it's like, well, what's the alternative? You know, you look at the West Bank and you look at Abbas, like, begging Netanyahu for a deal and enforcing nonviolence in a broad sense and not allowing for a third intifada, using coordination with Israel. So, like, that's what's needed for the Palestinians to inspire hope of the alternative.
A closing question comes to my mind, and Fania, it's partly prompted by a conversation I had with your late father. And as you know, he and I had many conversations over the years, but the second last one we had, I said to him, you've been campaigning for two states for 50 years. It hasn't happened. Surely you've got to think of a new idea. And he said to me, why so impatient? He said, you know, you come from Europe. The religious wars in Europe took, what, 500 years, 600 years to be resolved. It's impatient to think you're going to get this solved in your lifetime. It's almost arrogant to think it will be solved on your own personal timetable. What I didn't know was he was only 2 years away from the end of his own life when he said that. But it sounded to me as if he'd come to terms with the idea this would be something beyond his lifetime. Looking at both of you, and this may be partly a comment about all of our respective ages, but when you think about this, do you believe that the kind of vision both of you have been setting out is achievable in the time in which you will both see it? Or is this something that in a way, Fania, your late father was suggesting maybe the work of even centuries away? Why don't we start with you, Fania, and then Ahmed?
Well, first of all, Ahmed has a great advantage over me in age, so you will see more than I will, but I intend to live long and see what happens. I'm very curious. I'm a historian by profession. As you know, Jonathan, we all know well that sometimes history is very, very slow. Takes many ages for certain developments to come through, both political and technological. And then it runs like mad. The big moments of change. We may be facing a big moment of change. I don't know. There may be reversals. There may be pitfalls. The French Revolution was reversed more than once before it actually became to us in retrospect the decisive event of the late modern era. Maybe we are facing a decisive event now. Hearts and minds can change, not all of them, but under the right leadership and in the right international climate, things could start moving. And I would not be here and would not be active as I am if I didn't hope that this change will take place even within my own lifetime.
Ahmed.
Absolutely. I mean, look at like what happened after the Arab Spring and like the reversal of that. And that was a big, you know, moment of change and hope. But the way I see it is like there's two parallel tracks. One in which, yes, peace as in its classic sense that entails coexistence, that entails a departure away from violence and a genuine ability to coexist based on mutual humanity and love. That is a track that needs to be pursued. And that is certainly one that I think just at an individual mass adoption level will certainly take time. And I have every interest and intention of contributing to that path forward throughout my lifetime. But there's also a separate track that is absolutely, I hate to even use this term, top down that needs to take place in order to empower the former. Okay. So like Fani and I and tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands can love each other to infinity. But at the end of the day, we need an actual political framework led by leaders on both sides, even if it's a framework, even if it's a pathway, even if it's a seed that leads to something else, that is absolutely necessary and crucial. And I think that the latter is absolutely attainable within all of our lifetimes. And I actually think there's a real possibility. It's hard to see beyond just the immediate, you know, 6 months to a year. It's hard to believe it's been 6 months since October 7th. But like, I'm thinking the next 2 to 3 years, there will be political change in Israel. There will be an evolution to Hamas is evolving. It's going through a crisis. A lot of its leaders had no idea that October 7th was going to happen. It was really a decision made by Sinwar and Daif in Gaza. And they're having a crisis linking that military operation that was meant to inspire maximum perpetual chaos with Hamas's own political survival and political agenda. So there's either going to be a split within Hamas. There's going to be some kind of a realpolitik come to Jesus moment to be like, guys, like we need an exit strategy. I think within
come to Allah moment.
What's that?
I said, yeah, come yeah, to yeah. Allah no,
exactly.
Moment.
Like a moment to real. So like within the next 2 to 3 years, and I very much so support the idea of Israeli-Saudi normalization. Because I actually think the Saudis now hold a lot of leverage over incoming, current or future Israeli governments in offering this crown jewel, if you will, the most significant Arab country and Muslim country in the region, in exchange for a clear and an irreversible pathway towards the two-state solution. So I view that as an immense opportunity, possibly, and this is what I try to stress to the Palestinians, the final real opportunity we have to pressure Israel, not just, you know, international pressure, but like to actually have regional meaningful pressure on Israel to pursue the two-state solution. So I think the pathway towards sustainable and true peace among the peoples will take time, and the traumas will take, and it might be a generation or two. It might be some time, you know, but like if I and Fania and others can work across our differences and use our leverage, like, and keep that message, I think in due time, there will be many more like us. But separately, I strongly hope, and that's where I think the US administration has a role to play, the Arab voices and international voices, like you said, Fania, I think there is now, and unfortunately, due to the calamity of the horrible conditions in Gaza and what took place on October 7th, there's international interests like never before that I think once the immediateness of the situation kind of evolves or resolves or changes, there's a real pathway forward, in my humbled opinion.
So make peace with Saudi Arabia, not war with Iran. I think we can sum up in this way, and try to de-escalate the Gaza situation while ousting Hamas eventually as a goal. And of course, freeing the hostages. Mm-hmm. Inshallah, Ahmed. Inshallah.
Fania Salzberger, Ahmed Fouad Al-Khatib, thank you so much for talking to us. We don't know any of us if this will happen in our lifetimes, but you definitely made us feel better. So thank you both for that. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for having us.
Great talking to you all.
A couple of months ago, we had Michael Milstein and Sameh Sinijlawi, an Israeli and a Palestinian, on, and we got a huge response from that. Yes to what they said, the specific content, but also I think there was a very big reaction just to hearing an Israeli and Palestinian talking to each other in the midst of this war. Again, just hearing Fania Oz and Ahmed Fouad Al-Khatib talking to each other directly like that, and actually finding points of agreement and, you know, shared empathy for the fact they are both in some ways in this sort of shared struggle for moderation against extremists. It's just very heartening, and it somehow does feel the right time of year for that.
Listen, I thought they were, both of them together especially, but also separately, were very, very interesting. There were things that Ahmed was talking about that I didn't know. For example, the sort of skirmish within Hamas because of Sinwar's decision to go for October 7th, things like that. It's one of those conversations where we sort of just take a back seat and let it happen. I was, I think, in a way, cast in that role of the skeptic Israeli, asking questions to them about how real what they're saying, and as hopeful and inspiring as it is. To me, there's one note that I sort of have to say, the discussion about Yasser Arafat, and as much as we don't want to go into the past, we wanted to look into the future, but it should be said that even at the most courteous reading of Arafat, he did not stop Palestinian terror. He did not stop Hamas, not after the signing of the Oslo Accords, which resulted in a wave of terror in Israeli cities that essentially killed Oslo, and a wave of terror after the attempt at Camp David. He did not stop that. So I think it's important to say that. I think there was a caveat that Ahmed put in that. He said there's a moment in time where Arafat made a historic choice, and he said not before and not after. So I think that's an important, the after is important because that really set the stage for the 30 years that came after that. So just that, but I think I'm very happy when we have these conversations. I think, sadly, they rarely take place anywhere else.
Yeah, no, all too rare, and Unholy is a place where we aim to have those. It is award season.
Wait, before award season, can I mention something?
Yes, you can.
May I? I am holding, I don't think you have this. Do you have this?
Let me have another look. Go a bit closer. There you are. I don't have that.
I am
that.
Holding
You've got
the
it,
Hebrew
and I
version
don't have
of The Escape Artist, Jonathan Friedland's remarkable book that came out in Hebrew this very week. The book tells the story of Rudi Verba, only one of a handful of Jews who managed to escape Auschwitz. And what he tried to do was warn the Jews, particularly of Hungary, of what was awaiting them. This is not just a remarkable tale told by a very talented storyteller, but it's also incredibly relevant to today because it tells the story of what happens when you do have the information, when someone does tell you what is going on, and the gap between having the facts and believing them or acting upon them is something that I think we don't need to explain why is still so relevant in the world we live in. So this is the Hebrew edition. I'm so glad that I have it and you don't yet. It is in bookstores. If someone wants to listen to our conversation about The Escape Artist, I believe it's episode 62, and I grilled Jonathan about his book, but I can't recommend it more with more enthusiasm. This is a wonderful book, and please read it if you haven't in English. Now it's available in Hebrew. And now, after embarrassing you enough, we can go to our awards. Jonathan,
Well, a mensch award to you for mentioning the book. I'm so pleased. It's really meaningful to me that the book is coming out in Israel and in Hebrew, partly because for a long time, Rudi was, you know, overlooked in many places in the Jewish world. And it was a struggle. He was a quite controversial figure. It was difficult. So it's really meaningful to me that people in Israel will be able to read his extraordinary story. So thank you for that. Yes, our normal awards. Let's get back on track and not talk about ourselves, because that's where
a
British person wants to be. but go on, yeah, crowded field.
It's a pretty crowded field in the chutzpah world. I think we're doing a bit of a Pesach clearing of chametz. Chutzpahs, because we've accumulated a few. So can I start, maybe?
Yeah, no, fire away.
So I want to begin with the JVP. It's an organization. It's called the Jewish Voice for Peace. On the sort of spectrum of Jewish organizations, it's really, really at the far left. In Israel, in Hebrew, we say mismol rak hakir, which means left of them is only a wall. There's so much to the left. There's nothing left besides that. And they wrote an invite for the anti-Zionist Passover Seder. Now, I get that you're not down with Israel, fine. But this is the story of Passover, just to remind everybody. The Israel, Israelites, emancipated from slavery in Egypt, and then led by Moses into the Holy Land. The story is that they are led into the land that we will be Israel, their historical homeland. This is the story of Pesach. You can't have an anti-Zionist Passover Seder. That's like, I don't know, having an anti-Christian Easter or saying you're not going to celebrate Christmas because Santa is a privileged white man. No, you cannot do this. That's it. Sorry. That was my rant.
These have been around for a while, you know, the anti-Zionist say they are a little sort of counter tradition. And I always wonder how they deal with the closing song, chant, prayer of the proceedings, which is the Shana Haba Yerushalayim, next year in Jerusalem. Just before people sort of write in, I know how they deal with it, which is it's all a metaphor, and Jerusalem and Israel and Zion are just metaphors for a better world, is I think the way out of it. But yes, it is a challenge to mount a Seder with an anti-Zionist narrative, given it's about the children of Israel returning to Israel. So a worthy winner. In the same zone, the footage was shared this week by Omid Jalili, who is a British-Iranian actor and performer, in which he was pretty dumbfounded by seeing video of a sort of teach-in for American left activists. I realize they are the target of both of our chutzpah nominations, the American left.
Wait, I got a third, so don't worry about it.
Oh, good. So they're having a kind of teach-in where they are being taught the chants they should cry, and the instructor is teaching them in Farsi a chant which they very happily chant. They do it once or twice, the whole chorus, they give him an applause, and then somebody thinks to ask him what the chant means that they've been learning, and he tells them it means death to Israel.
He actually says it's either down with Israel or death to Israel. They're two definitions.
Yeah, I mean, there are two possibilities, down with Israel or death to Israel. And then someone in the group, eager to ingratiate himself with the teacher, then goes, can we get a death to America? Yeah, sure, says the teacher to these American leftists, and leads them all in a collective chant of death to America. Omid Jalili and others have seized on this and said, you know, the Palestinians really do need better allies than people like this, who only damage their cause and alienate potential supporters.
Yeah, it reminds you of that lynching scene, the lynching mob in The Simpsons, where they go after someone and someone yells, no, that's not him, it's the other guy. And the lynch mob just turns around and goes to the other guy, like they just want the lynch, and then they're just turning to whatever is convenient. It's a pretty remarkable video. I have a last chutzpah nominee, if I may. This comes close to home, the IDF Home Front Command. Now, normal times, this is a very well-respected, well-regarded institution. It's a very important unit in the IDF. It tells the Israeli citizens how to protect themselves at times of crisis and tension. Even, I can tell you, the night of the Iran attack and other events like these, there's a representative of the IDF Home Front Command sitting in the studio telling people, giving them advice on how, or instructions rather, on how to act and what to do, when to go to the shelter, etc. Now, why is there nominated in the Chutzpah Award? Because obviously, through the when the Iran story was breaking all through these days, there was a round-the-clock assessment, and they decided to go back to normal, meaning opening up kindergarten, schools, all of the activities for Pesach, but they made the decision at midnight on Sunday. Now, if you're a parent to small children, you will not see this announcement at midnight. You will be sleeping. So most of the parents and a lot of the municipalities that had to organize the opening of these institutions saw it in the morning. So this was the situation on Monday early morning. One of the people on Twitter, her name is Racheli Freifeld. She's a copyright. She said, only in Israel will you have 9 hours to prepare for a drone attack, but only 15 minutes to prepare 3 children to go to kindergarten. They united all of Israelis in the fury of this decision being made at midnight. So just a little adding on to the Chutzpah Awards of this week.
A rare moment of unity, it seems, for the Israeli public. And I feel
getting the Mensch Award is what you're saying.
I detect a certain degree of personal investment in this story from you, Yoni Levy.
You did just a little bit.
I can't imagine why just that talk of 3 children and getting them out and to school.
Yeah, you tried to convince 3 small children who thought they were having the day off at home to go to school in kindergarten. Good luck with that. Even your, you know, beautiful words can't get that to happen.
Despite the fact that they did bring the nation together, we're not saying that the Home Front Command is the mensch of the week. Instead, you have another suggestion for that.
I do. And this is Harrison Bader. He's a center fielder for the New York Mets. That is a conclusion of my knowledge in baseball, but a very big star. And he is Jewish. He has been wearing not only the Star of David on his belt, also the necklace of the hostages given to him. He's also walking around with that. I'm sad to say these are days in which doing both of these things is considered courageous, but I think that we should point out that people who are in the public eye and do this with no trepidation are people that I think that we should mention. And he is, I think, quite a mensch in that regard.
A good choice. It remains for us to wish our listeners a very good and happy and peaceful Pesach. We hope that we can get that at the very least. And if there are families coming together with different opinions, do go back to that episode where Rabbi Angela Buchdahl gave some very good tips for how to handle
last
that.
Last Friday, the episode from last Friday.
Just last Friday, and she also burst into song rather beautifully. So that will get you in the mood. You can go back and listen to that segment as we all prepare for Pesach.
And we will say our thank yous to Gaia Glaser, Omer Primat, Omri Barak, and Sniri Amin. And you have a calm Pesach, I think is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, and I wish you very much the same, Yoni. I mean, you know, it's even more important that it's calm where you are. But to everyone listening and to you, all of you, Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.